Welcome and thank you all for joining this exciting new course called Book Smart. So if any of you were looking to become book smart, this is exactly where you need to be. Right here, right now. So I want to, as is our custom, looking around the room, some first-time JLI students. So we want to give them a very warm Texas welcome. First of all, raise your hand if it's your first JLI course, so everybody could meet you. Wow, very nice. That's Jack and Sarah, who I just met, and then Abby and Jacob, who I just met, JP, who we were in touch, but we still just met today, and then Barbara, who I also met today. Welcome, and thank you all for joining us.
All of them sitting in the second row.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. You gotta be cautious before you come to the front row when the rabbi's talking. So welcome to Book Smart, and as I said, this is going to, you know what, let's do this. If you turn towards your left in the back of the room, you see some bookcases there. And in general, when you walk into Jewish institutions, synagogues, most certainly schools, yeshivas, you'll always find books and books and books and more books. And that's because we have 3,000 plus years of Jewish learning. Now the reality is that in days of yore, literacy was something that was reserved for a fraction of society. I can't tell you exactly what the percentage was, but generally speaking, it was reserved for the elite, for the leadership, for the priest, etc., etc. But the masses largely remained illiterate. That's true about society in general, but that was never true about the Jewish community, the Jewish people. And that's because, as I'm sure most of you are familiar, when we say in the most fundamental Jewish prayer, which begins with Shema Yisrael, but if you continue reading a few lines, you know what you're going to find? Vishinantam Livanecha. You should teach it to your children. And that was told to the Jewish people over 3,300 years ago. And they never stopped teaching to their children ever since then. And this is why education and literacy was always a top priority when it came to the Jewish people. And this is why we are blessed to have so many books. And this is why until today, literacy, learning, and study is a very high up their value. And obviously this is why we're all gathered here together, to continue learning, growing our knowledge and our understanding of Jewish literature. Now what's unique about this course, and we have, by the way, if it's your first course here, we have three flagship JLI courses per year. We concluded one, the fall course, a few weeks ago. This is the winter course. We'll have one more spring course after Passover. So, today, this course is, even though we've had many, and we will have, that kind of cover a specific topic, if you will, tackling a certain genre. In this case, of this course, it's unique in that we are doing something more ambitious, if you will, and that is to explore the entirety of Jewish literature in this course. And basically we're going to be doing six different areas of or genres within Jewish literacy over the next six sessions starting tonight. And each one will be addressing a different topic or area of Jewish literature. And we're not just going, even though it's very ambitious to do that, and you would think that all you can get is just a little bit of information about each one. So the truth is, however, we're not just going to be talking about each one and giving an overview of each one. We're also going to actually be experiencing each one. So today, for example, we're going to be talking generally about the Bible. We'll get into it soon. But let's say next week, where we talk about the Talmud, we're not just going to be talking about the Talmud, we're actually going to kind of get into it and experience what it's like to have a Talmudic debate. And that's true about the subsequent classes as well. And each one will actually experience what a Midrash is, not just talking about it, but we'll analyze one. And the same is about Kabbalah, Musar, Chakira, which is philosophy, Hasidic philosophy, etc. So I'm excited, and I'm sure you are too, and that's what brought you here tonight. So, when I say Torah, what's your one-word reaction? What do you think of first when I say Torah? It could be two words.
Bible.
Sefer
Torah.
Sefer Torah.
Chumash.
Chumash. Great. All great.
Knowledge.
Knowledge.
History.
History. Another good one. All good. All true. Anything else? When you think of Torah, what comes to mind?
Jews.
Learning.
Learning. Yes.
Jews.
Jews. Law. Law. Great one. Lawyer? No. Okay. All great answers. So, and they're all true. When we talk about Torah, and specifically the topics that we're going to be discussing, so Torah, and we're going to do a lot about in analyzing and learning what Torah means tonight, and follow up subsequent Monday nights, we're going to be talking about Midrash, Talmud, Kabbalah, Halacha, which is Jewish law, Musar, and Hasidism, let's just say. We're going to be talking about where they were authored, who authored them, the era during which they came onto to the Jewish scene and became part of Jewish literature. And like I said, we're also going to be actually experiencing each one. How about taking a look in your student book? Please join me on page 3. And you will find in figure 1.1 a course map. Course map, genres of Torah, and this will tell you what each class is going to look like. So you'll see tonight, lesson 1, we're going to be talking about the Torah, prophets, and scriptures, and as you can tell, lesson 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 follow, so feel free to take a look at that as well. There's also a timeline map which came with your books, is that correct? Did you find one?
Yeah.
By the way, so there's a timeline map, and that's going to be very helpful for you as we go through tonight's class and the entire course. So hold on to that. Don't lose it. It presents an outline of the various areas of Torah that we're going to be discussing during this course, and along with some of the other major works that each one comprises. So, so this is what it looks like, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't get one, but the main thing is that you do have one. Okay, so with that, let's move along, let's get ready to jump in. Like I said, we have a lot of work. We're going to be learning a lot of wonderful information. So just to let you know in advance what we're going to be covering tonight, we can say that tonight's session is going to consist of 3 acts. Number 1, would the real Torah please stand up? Number 2, unraveling the scroll. And number 3, scriptural DNA. That's what the 3... if we want to break up tonight's lesson, it's going to be into those 3. So, if you go to page 3 as well on your in your student book, figure 1.2, we have 2 definitions of Torah. Okay, we have A. What do you see? In fact, before somebody said Sefer Torah. And that's exactly what we see in photograph A, which is the Torah. In fact, We have an ark right over there, which is the east wall of our sanctuary, which is that half of this room. We're in the multi-purpose room, half of this room. But that's the ark, and in it there are two Torahs, two Sefer Torahs. Sefer means a book in Hebrew, but of course in this case it's a scroll. So when we say Torah, this is what we think of. And this is also true. Torah is the Torah scroll. But if you look at the second picture, picture B, what do you see? You see an extensive library. Is that correct?
Yeah.
All right. I'm not sure which yeshiva this is, but it's quite the library. It doesn't even look like a bookstore. It looks like a yeshiva's library. So number one is a parchment scroll kept in the Ark of the Synagogue, and B is Jewish literary works compiled throughout history. So these are two different images that come up when we think of the word Torah. This is Torah, and that's Torah. We'll just take a minute to welcome those who are just joining us. Thank you for joining. Looks like Uri through the woods.
Yeah.
And please take a seat.
Okay, thank you.
I just want to make sure we're not... welcome, please join us so we can continue seamlessly. Thank you for joining, Nick and Uri. Here are two books.
I brought a friend today.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you very much. There's two seats right here to my right if we need two or two together. Welcome back, Nick, and welcome, Uri, to a first-time JLI student. So before, we gave a special welcome to first-timers, so we're extending that to you as well.
Thank you.
So we're on page 3 in the student book, if you want to join, and we are talking about two different images that come up when we think of the Torah. Number one was the actual Torah scroll, which... Of course, when you think Torah, this is what you think about. We actually read from this Torah, from a Torah scroll, every single Saturday, every Shabbat in synagogue. But also, by the way, on Mondays and Thursdays, it's a shorter reading. But in every synagogue, there's a shorter 5-minute reading on every Monday and Thursday morning. And the reason for that is, by the way, because it was established by Moses that the Jewish people should not go 3 days without Torah, because water is Torah, and the Jewish people, after not having water for 3 days, they started to go crazy. They didn't have water, and all the problems started, all the kvetching. And water, which represents Torah, which comes from above to below, ever since then it was instituted that the Jews can't go 3 days without it. In truth, we study Torah every day, but a formal reading we actually do 3 times a week for that reason. But that's just an aside. Coming back to our topic over here. So when you think of Torah, that's number one. And by the way, the Chumash, I think Jack said Chumash, right? The word Chumash refers to the 5 books of Moses. The word Chumash comes from the number 5 in Hebrew, which is Chamesh. So it refers to the 5 books of Moses, which, by the way, is this book right here. Happens to be that this is like this one has both Hebrew and English. Welcome. And it also has some commentary. That's why it's a little bit longer than you would think, meaning it doesn't have to be this thick if it's just the 5 books of Moses. Anybody know or want to guess how many words are in the 5 books of Moses, the Bible? Yes.
I think it's 16,000. No, 16,000.
You got your guess. Next. Anyone else?
Maybe I'm thinking of verses.
No one's judging you. Just knock it out.
308,000.
Okay, I hear you. That's how many letters there are in the Torah. Anyone else? How many words in the Torah? If it's 308,000 letters, then how many words is it?
100,000.
Okay.
But they're all average about four letters.
80 something. Okay, any other guesses? I think that's it. So we have a winner. He said 80 something. He's closest. It's 79,961 or 976. 79,976, right under 80,000. Which, by the way, the average novel is about, is from 70,000 to 120,000 words. That means that the Bible is like on the slender side of a novel. That's not a very big book, but yet it's the all-time bestseller, as we know, and it was transcribed by a single individual, by Moses, over a 40-year period when the Jewish people were in the desert in the years 1313 plus before the Common Era.
But we're talking about the Torah, just the Torah.
Right? Right now, so far, we've been talking about the Torah, meaning the five books of Moses. What everything that exists within the Torah scroll, which is the five books. So that is one Torah that we talk about. But then we also said that there's another Torah. When we look at this library and I ask you what's in here, you'll tell me the Torah. If you were talking to your friend when you were driving here tonight, and you have to hang up, there's a very good chance that you said, I got to go because I have a Torah class tonight. Now, you didn't necessarily think that we're going to be discussing the five books of Moses. You still would refer to any Torah study that you have to study Torah or that you're studying Torah, regardless of what part of Jewish literature it is. So, what is Torah? Is Torah the five books of Moses? Or is Torah any book that you pull off this very vast and extensive library? Or any book off of those shelves right there, for that matter? So, in Jerusalem, there's an organization called Otsar HaChachma. Literally, it kind of means, Otsar is like treasure, and Chachma means of wisdom. And they set out to digitize all of every Jewish work, every Jewish book that exists. And as of now, they're holding by 120,000 volumes that have already been digitized. 120,000. And number one, they're not finished yet. And number two, there are many, many works of Judaism that were written over the last 3,000 years, but we do not even have them today. They didn't even survive. People wrote, obviously the printing press is not that old, but before that, things were handwritten. I mean, I know, for example, the founder of the Chabad movement, Rabbi Schneur Zalman, we have some incredible works of his, which are studied by thousands every day, like the Tanya, like his Code of Jewish Law, and others. But we also know that he wrote other books which were unfortunately destroyed in a fire. And if it was burned down, they don't exist anymore. It's gone. So that's just one scenario. But you have many others due to persecution. If you were on the run, you couldn't necessarily take books with you or everything you wanted to take with you when in those circumstances. So a lot of it didn't even survive. But what they already have is 120,000 books, different books that are already digitized. And all of them are referred to as Torah as well. So, how do we call both of them Torah? And the answer is that we, both the Torah scroll and the general Torah, are called by the same name. They are two articulations of the same body of wisdom and knowledge. So it's like two sides of the same coin. They're both referred to as Torah. And we'll appreciate this more and more as our class tonight unfolds. So the question is, what's the relationship between these two Torahs? We have Torah A and Torah B. Torah A, the scroll. Torah B, everything else. But what is? How do they interplay? What's the relationship between the two? And how did Torah A develop into Torah B? So keep that in mind, and that's something that we're going to be addressing as we proceed. Any quick questions or comments? Obviously, a lot of your questions will be addressed and answered as we proceed, But, yes.
I'm assuming that Torah B is continuous development, right? With Torah A is static.
Excellent point.
Interpretation of Torah A.
Yes. Definitely an aspect of B is that it's an interpretation of A, most certainly. And, as we'll also discuss, A is what it is, B is still unfolding. Every year, many, many hundreds, if not more, of books of Torah are published. Okay, so these two, A and B, are also referred to by the written Torah, and Torah B, the rest of Jewish literature, referred to as the oral Torah. Okay, we're going to be talking a lot about that tonight, so keep that in mind. More specifically, when we say the written Torah is not only the five books of Moses, which I held up before and I'm holding now. This is just the five books of Moses. And it says that right here. I brought some props today. One second. In this book right here, here we have what is still called the written Torah, strictly. And in fact, everything that is part of the written Torah, and we'll explain that term soon, everything that you would call the written Torah is in this book. If you are familiar a little bit with Hebrew terminology, this would be called the Tanakh. Ever heard of that term? By raise of hand? Most of you? Some of you? Most of you? Tanakh. Anyone know what it stands for?
Torah, Nevetim, and Kevetim.
Yes, between the two of you, you're right. Torah, Nevi'im, the N in there, the Nun is Nevi'im, which means prophets, and then the Chaf, the Ch of Tanakh, stands for Ketuvim, which means the writings. And we'll be talking about all of that. So all of those are in this book right here, about the same thick, but this only has the five books, and this has the whole Tanakh right here. Now, this has the five books of Moses, it has the prophets, which consists of eight books of the prophets, and then it has another 11 books, which are the writings. And we'll hear a lot more about that shortly.
Are you going to let me ask a question?
I let everybody ask questions. You can ask anyone who's been here.
My understanding is that, well, at least before, what I've heard is that the oral Torah is Mishnah and Gemara, not everything.
Mishnah and Talmud is part of the oral Torah. It's not the only part of the oral Torah.
Okay.
But largely, we're not going to get specific about the oral Torah tonight. Tonight, we're going to discuss about the oral Torah tonight, but we're not going to get into it. That's going to be next Monday evening. By the way, what's your first name?
Just
Leon. Yeah, I know we met once before. Thank you for joining us. Just so you know, in general, we do take kind of quicker questions during the class. I do stay on afterwards if anyone has something that would take a little bit more time. We try to stay shorter and on point during the class so that we can move along. All right. So what I just said before was that green book that I was holding is called the written Torah. Why is it called written? Because it was written down, obviously, that's the name of it, but also because, as we'll see in text number one, you know what, how about we actually read text number one? I'm going to start from Kim. It's a one-liner, text number one, it's from the Talmud on page 4 in your student book. This gives us a little bit of an idea of the difference, and it's a good place to start. Please.
The words that were given in writing, you are not allowed to communicate them orally. And the words that were taught orally, you are not allowed to communicate them in writing.
Thank you. So the written Torah was transcribed, as I mentioned, by Moses. The later prophets transcribed the divine communications that they received in the form of prophecy by divine inspiration, and we'll unpack this as well a little bit later. And then the oral Torah, we refer to it as the oral Torah or oral tradition, and that's because it wasn't transcribed. It's not how it was given. Unlike the Torah, which was, and we're going to talk more about it soon, but the Torah, five books, was transcribed word for word from God to Moses, and the other two sections of the written Torah as well, although not on the same level as the five books. Again, we'll come back to that. Versus the oral Torah, which was never actually meant to be written down. The oral tradition was passed down from teacher to student from the beginning, and that's actually originally how it was intended to remain. The Mishnah and the Talmud were never meant to be written down. They were meant to remain an oral tradition that goes from teacher to student, parent to child, a living, breathing, ongoing conversation. The only, and we'll discuss this, I believe, in lesson three more extensively, but because of the danger of and the risk of losing all of these teachings due to persecution, etc., the sages of the time said that we should commit it to writing, even though it wasn't originally intended to be so. We'll do it anyway so that we don't lose it. So originally, though, as we just read in that text that Kim read for us, originally the written Torah was supposed to be written, the oral tradition, only oral. But yet, now what does that mean? What does it mean that the written Torah is supposed to be written? Of course it's written. Of course it's written on parchment. But even though we teach it, and we also, of course, talk about those teachings, we have to, because we want to teach them, but at the same time, we always do it based on the text. It's not only something that goes from teacher to student. It's not only done in conversation or in discussions, but rather it's always based on the very specific text of the written Torah, versus the oral tradition, which primarily the way it's communicated is through live conversation and discussion. In other words, the Torah is designed to exist on two distinct formats. There's supposed to be a written text, and then there's also supposed to be an oral conversation. So, the question remains, what are the reasons for this dichotomy? Why is there these two different components of the written Torah versus the oral Torah? So this we kind of went through already. The written Torah is an unalterable text. Every individual letter is significant, and it includes the 24 books of the Tanakh. When we say that every letter is significant, by the way, if in the middle of a public reading on Shabbat, there could be 10 people in the synagogue or 1,000 people in the synagogue. In the middle of the reading, the reader discovers that one letter is kind of half faded, or there's a mistake. You know what has to happen with that Torah? If it's missing one letter, it's wrapped up and becomes disqualified from being used in a public setting, because every single letter is significant in the written Torah. And it's put away, and a different one comes out to continue the reading. That's how important it is, and that's how significant every single individual letter is when it comes to the written Torah specifically. In the oral Torah, handed over from teacher to disciple, originally prohibited to be transcribed, and includes teachings succeeding the 24 books of Tanakh. So, the question remains, as we said, why both? And before we delve a little bit deeper to understand the relationship in between the written Torah versus the oral Torah, we're going to try to understand and become more familiar with the written Torah. And for that, we're going to turn to the video screen, which is significant. It's not just a contribution to the class, but it's going to present a very important part of tonight's lesson. So I'm going to ask you to turn your attention to it, and it's going to give us a very good understanding of the written Torah, and then we'll pick up the conversation from there. This we went through already, and we will come back to this slide. Actually, now we're going to go to the video. Did we pass it already or no?
Maybe pass it.
1 second.
Or maybe missing volume.
Tanakh. No book has had a greater impact on human history, on human civilization. No book has been more devoutly read, more diligently studied, more deeply probed. What's in the Tanakh? Who wrote it or transcribed it? And when? Join us for a journey that spans thousands of years, a journey traversed by shepherds and kings, prophets and prophetesses, scribes and seers, as we explore the 24 books, the 929 chapters, and the 22,864 verses that comprise the Jewish Bible. The Tanakh consists of three components: Torah, Nevi'im, or prophets, and Ketuvim, or writings. The first section, Torah, is the most fundamental text of Judaism, transcribed by Moses during the 40 years that the people of Israel were traveling through the wilderness. This is the text inscribed in the Torah scroll, the most sacred object in Judaism. The Torah consists of five books, the five books of Moses, also called the Chumash. The Torah recounts the origins of the Jewish people, but even more importantly, it contains the 613 mitzvot, divine commandments, that define our mission in life and the covenant between God and the people of Israel. The book of Genesis describes the creation of the world and the formative events of early human history. Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, Cain and Abel, Noah's flood, the Tower of Babel, and the lives and deeds of the founding fathers and mothers of the people of Israel: Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob, Rachel and Leah, Joseph and his brothers. Genesis also includes the seven Noahide laws and three of the 613 mitzvot of the Torah. The book of Exodus describes the exodus from Egypt, the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai, and the construction of the tabernacle. It includes the Ten Commandments and 101 other mitzvot. The book of Leviticus records 247 mitzvot commanded by God to Moses pertaining to the temple service, the kosher dietary laws, the festivals of the Jewish year, and a variety of ritualistic, social, and civil laws, including the maxim, love your fellow as yourself. The book of Numbers recounts the events of the Israelites' 40-year journey through the wilderness. It also includes 52 mitzvot. The book of Deuteronomy contains Moses' final address to the people of Israel before his passing. It reviews many of the events and laws of the previous three books, as well as 200 additional mitzvot. A Jew lives with the Torah 365 days a year, and the five books are divided into 54 sections, or parshiot. Each week, another parsha is publicly read in the synagogue, and each parsha has seven sections so that each day of the week has its distinct lesson of the day to study and apply to our lives. The eight books of the prophets section of Tanakh record the words and deeds of the prophets who brought the word of God to the people in the centuries after Moses. The first four books in this section are primarily historical, recounting the events from the children of Israel's settlement of the Holy Land to the destruction of the first temple. The book of Joshua describes the conquest of the Holy Land and its apportionment among the 12 tribes of Israel. Judges describes events during the 14 generations of the judges who led the people of Israel in the centuries after the passing of Joshua. The book of Samuel recounts the lives and deeds of the prophet Samuel, King Saul, and King David. And Kings recounts the history of the kingdoms of Judah and Israel. Isaiah was sent by God to convey prophecies of consolation over the destruction of the Holy Temple and the exile, and to describe the future messianic age of peace, perfection, and divine revelation. Jeremiah warned that Jerusalem will be destroyed because of the people's sins and injustices, but also conveyed the promise that the exiles to Babylon will return after 70 years. Ezekiel described his vision of the divine chariot that is the source for many of the mystical teachings of Kabbalah and of the third holy temple of the Messianic era. The last book in the prophets section is composed of 12 smaller books recording the prophecies of 12 prophets. Hosea, who God instructs to marry an unfaithful woman in order to experience firsthand God's interminable love for his people despite their unfaithfulness. Amos, who denounces the exploitation of the weak and poor by the rich and powerful, and speaks about the hypocrisy in serving God while failing to practice justice and charity. The story of Jonah, which teaches the power of prayer and of repentance. Joel and Nahum, who foretell the divine judgment of the nations who persecuted the people of Israel. Obadiah, Micah, Habakkuk, and Zephaniah prophesy the future messianic age of peace and perfection when all nations will unite to serve God. And the last three prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, encourage the people during the difficulties of their return from Babylon to build the second temple. The words of the prophets are also incorporated into the annual Torah reading cycle in the form of the Haftorah, selected portions from the prophets which we read after the public Torah reading on Shabbat and other special occasions. The third section of Tanakh, the writings, include 11 books composed by King David in the Holy Land some 3,000 years ago. The Psalms of the Book of Tehillim express the yearnings, tribulations, and exaltations of the Jewish experience in every land and in every generation. Psalms form an integral part of every Jewish prayer and are read, wept, and sung at every occasion from a birth to a funeral. Whenever a Jew has the need to plead for divine assistance, celebrate a triumph, or simply talk to God, the verses of Tehillim give voice to the outpourings of his or her soul. Also in the writing sections are three books containing the wisdom of King Solomon. Proverbs contains aphorisms on the virtues of wisdom, hard work, and a moral life. Song of Songs is a pastoral love song that metaphorically describes the relationship between God and Israel. Ecclesiastes speaks of the transience of life and the futility of worldly pursuits. Also in the writing section, the book of Job confronts the question, why do the righteous suffer? Ruth tells the story of the Moabite princess who converted to Judaism and became the ancestress of King David. Lamentations mourns the destruction of the Holy Temple and the exile of Israel. The scroll of Esther recounts the story of Purim, when Haman's plot to annihilate all the Jews in the Persian Empire was foiled by Queen Esther and Mordecai. The visions and deeds of Daniel, the Judean prince who served in the royal courts of Babylonia and Persia, are in the book that bears his name. Daniel also prophesied on the rise and fall of nations and the timing of the messianic redemption. Ezra Nehemiah describes the Jewish people's return from Babylon, the reestablishment of their commitment to the Torah, and the building of the second holy temple. Chronicles contains a summary of the whole of biblical history. Five of the books of the writings section, also called the Five Scrolls, are publicly read in select times of the year. The Scroll of Esther on Purim, Ruth on Shavuot, Song of Songs on Passover, Lamentations on Tisha B'Av, and Ecclesiastes on Sukkot. 1,000 years after the revelation at Sinai, in the first generation of the Second Temple era, the 120 prophets and sages of the Great Assembly canonized the 24 books of the Tanakh. This is the written Torah, upon which all subsequent Torah learning and discussion is based.
That is incredible.
Great job.
Yep.
Wow. So, this gave us a very good and clear understanding of what the Tanakh is, what the Bible is, and what it means when we say the Torah, or more specifically, the written Torah, consisting of the 24 books, three sections of the Torah, the five books, the prophets, and the writings. So now that we know this, I want to ask you a different question. Imagine that you are a librarian or a manager of a bookstore. But imagine also that there was no such thing as a religion section. And somebody came in and handed you the Torah. In which section in the library or in the bookstore would you place it? Please call out where you would put it.
Under T.
T.
Answer of the day.
You should have one for all those different sections. Have one for law, have one for all the different sections.
A few pages here, a few pages there.
The whole thing.
So everywhere? Anywhere else? Just shoot out some ideas, please.
History. Philosophy.
History, that's correct. Philosophy is correct.
Ethics.
Ethics, great.
Law.
Law, also great.
Self-help.
Yes. Somebody once walked into a bookstore and asked where the self-help section is. And they said, if I answered you, I would defeat the purpose, right? So,
That's a good one.
All correct. So the question is, and this too, did you want to say something?
Some of them were in different time. And my question is, it looks like it's divided in 54 weeks, he mentioned, or the person mentioned. So he's treating each book with the same allocation of time. And maybe there are some books that are more relevant, and that's the reason RF is organized systematically for a reason. I'm going there in the same of, looks like someone aggregated them later and divided by 54.
So, you're saying something important, but let me try to clarify a little bit. So you're not answering my question, right? Before you're bringing up an important point. So in other words, I think what you're addressing more is another question of how does it work as far as how would you define these, or what would be the difference really of the three sections within the written Torah? When you said 54, you're referring to the five books of Moses in particular, right?
Well, so then I was confused. So that was specifically for that, okay.
54, you're referring to what we read throughout the year? That is only the Bible, the five books of Moses aspect of the Tanakh. So we don't read this whole book. Yes, we do read some sections from it, as it was noted at the end of each reading, called Haftorah. But from the actual scroll itself, we only read from Genesis till the end of Deuteronomy. That's the first of these three sections that comprise the written Torah. So the question really is, what is it about these three different sections? And if there is a difference, or what would be the significance really of this threefold division? Why is it split up this way? There's, within the written Torah, there's first the Torah, the five books, then the prophets, then the writings. What is the difference in between the three? And this is where I think you may be, what you're referring to. Some would suggest that this is basically a chronological layout of events. It starts from creation till Moses, that ends the Bible. And then we pick up from Joshua and so on and so forth. So there's something to that, but the problem is that it's not entirely true. because it's not exactly like that. Because, for example, the book of Job, you know who wrote Job? Moses wrote the book of Job, even though it's part of the later books, the later works. It's in the writings.
But the prophecies of Nevi'im, but the prophecies that are in the land of Israel, they were made in the land of Israel, but the book of Daniel is in the writings because it was a prophecy made outside of the land of Israel. So the prophecies that are made in the land of Israel are in the book, in the Nevi'im section, and the rest of it is in the Ketuvim section.
Everything? The question is, even if there's truth to that, but not necessarily is that exclusive and black and white. But again, there's something to that, but it still doesn't explain it fully. We still have to understand what's the difference in between these three and why each one is defined kind of in its own light. And that is what we're going to be discussing for the next little while. Any quick questions or comments? Did you have something?
Okay. I thought you were asking a question. I was trying to answer it.
Okay.
I'll be more patient.
No. It's all good. You're an involved student. So the reason for the division is that these three sections actually represent, and this is the key, three different modes of divine communication. Okay, we're going to be discussing three different modes of divine communication, and that is where we come to these three different sections of the Bible, if you will. Okay, it's not just because that's how they were played out or other factors, even though there's truth to them. But the real difference and significant difference, or most significant difference, is the fact that we're talking about three different modes of divine communication. So, let's go from the top. Okay, what is the first one? We're going to talk about the five books of Moses, the Torah, everything that appears in the Torah scroll. What defines the way that specifically was communicated from God to Moses? How exactly was that communicated?
Face-to-face.
Excellent. And we're actually going to, you know what, I'm going to ask Jacob to actually read that verse in text number 3 on page 9. Please read both verses there from Exodus and Numbers.
God will speak to Moses face to face as a man speaks to his fellow. If there is a prophet among you, I, God, will make myself known to them in a vision. I will speak to them in a dream. Not so is my servant Moses. In all of my house he is trusted. Mouth to mouth I speak with him in a vision, and not in riddles. He gazes at the image of God.
Thank you very much. So this describes how the Torah, the five books of Moses, were communicated. This is the, let's just say, the highest, most authoritative way of communication between God and the people, which exists in the Bible. And that is that God spoke to Moses as I am speaking to you right now, face to face, not in riddles, etc., which we'll talk about in a second, but very clearly, and it was as if he was seeing it. And that is true about every word. Like we said before, every word and every letter in the Torah. That's why every letter is significant, more than in the other works, as we'll see, because it was communicated from God to Moses in this way, like no other prophet experienced. So that is number one. In other words, and I'm going to explain Moses a little more by also explaining the next type of communication, and that is the prophets. How do the prophets differ from the way Moses got his communications? When a prophet received a prophecy and then recorded it, to understand it, we can try to imagine that it is like if you go to a museum and you saw some magnificent pieces of art or whatever. And then you come home and either you share with your family members, or then the following Shabbat at synagogue, you meet your friends and you're telling them about what you saw. When you are communicating what you saw, how are you communicating it? Meaning, what are you conveying? Are you conveying exactly what that piece of art is, or are you conveying the way you processed, appreciated that piece, and now you're communicating the way you perceived it? It's the latter, correct? Because I'm not showing my friend the piece of art. I'm telling them how I, what impression it made on me. That would be more like the way a prophet communicated when he or she received a prophecy from God. So let's just say God communicated something to the prophet, but it may have been a riddle. It may have been in a dream. And now the prophet was responsible to decipher the prophecy and then communicate what they deciphered. So this is already a step down from the way Moses received his communication. God spoke to Moses with impeccable clarity. There was no room for doubt or questions. He knew exactly what he's hearing. That's exactly what he conveyed. When it comes to the prophet processed what he or she received, and then, based on their understanding, went and conveyed it and shared it with the people. So they put their imprint on it radically more than Moses did on the five books. In fact, Moses didn't put his imprint on the five books. It was just like he was dictating what he heard from God. Think of like a court reporter?
Stenographer,
right? So exactly what you hear, that's what is recorded. And you don't even play a role. You're just putting it down on paper. The prophet, however, was relied upon to decipher the message and then convey it. So yes, the message came from God, 100%. The prophet didn't make stuff up on their own.
How do we know that?
How do we know? Because
how did they get that gravitas? I'm sure there was a lot of prophets walking around.
There were prophets.
How did they decide that Samuel was a prophet and Joe wasn't?
Because you have to.
Is there a test?
You have absolutely. You, if you said a prophecy or you predicted the future, did it happen or did it not happen?
Some of them predicted future, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years from now. From then.
Well, so time will tell. The test is still going. unless it was already proven or disproven, but if they're part of the Torah, obviously they were already proven.
But they're not waiting until that happens. They already included it in the.
Well, obviously, because they were already proven as valid prophets.
Like
it's not that the only thing they said was the future of Mashiach. Right. That was part of their prophecy, but they were already proven to be a prophet of God. By the way, I think we discussed this in one of the recent courses. If a prophet said something of a negative nature, a doom and gloom prophecy, and it didn't happen, that does not disprove that prophet. Because God does change his mind when it comes to negative things. It's possible that the people repented and the event doesn't happen. But when it's a good prophecy, then it's never taken back. So if a prophet prophecies something positive and it doesn't happen, you know for certain that they're a false prophet. But let's not get carried away. Let's stay on message here. So now we're understanding the second level of communication from God, which is through the prophet. And in the case of the prophet or the prophetess is relied upon for their own personal imprint on the message, because they had to decipher it and communicate it as such. So we already have the first and the second. Let's just take a look at what we have here. So levels of revelation. We have direct communication, which is God to Moses. And we read it in the verse. It's like somebody speaks to his friend. That's how God spoke to Moses, face to face. And then we have indirect communication. Indirect communication is God to the prophets, which, of course, we also quoted from the Bible for that. And then all the 613 commandments, by the way, are included in the five books of Moses. The prophets did not add any commandments. They prophesied about keeping the commandments. They did not add any. Every single one of the 613 come from the five books of Moses. And by the way, another way to know if a prophet was true or false was if they suggested to modify anything within the Torah. If a prophet came and said, we don't need to observe Shabbat anymore in the name of God, we know they don't need to be tested further. We know 100% that they're false. If they come and add a mitzvah and said, actually, there's 614 commandments, we know without further inquiry that it's a false prophet, because they were not there to add anything or subtract anything from the Torah. The Torah is exactly what it is, and that wasn't their role. Their role was to inspire, was to rebuke, was to warn, etc., etc., but not to add or subtract anything to or from the Torah. As we just said, exhort an individual or community to repent for a wrongdoing, warn of a future calamity or how to avoid it, provide hope with divine promises of future salvation. All of that is what the role of the prophet was, but not to do anything or modify the Torah itself. So we already talked about two out of the three. We talked about the five books, God communicating to Moses. We talked about the prophets, how God communicated to the prophets. But then the third is the writings. And the writings is another step down, if you will, and that we refer to as a term that you may have heard of. In Hebrew, it's called Ruach HaKodesh. Anyone know the translation? Literally, you could say Holy Spirit, or maybe divine inspiration, loosely translated. So they communicated and their teachings of those books based on divine inspiration. So it's a further step away. The prophet received a communication from God, but now the prophet needed to decipher it, understand it, and present it. So you were getting it the way they understood it. When you continue to the third phase, to the writings over there, the individual who's transcribing it was doing so not by hearing a message from God, but rather by being inspired by God as they were writing. And that is called Ruach HaKodesh. That's called divine inspiration. Inspiration for writings. As King David says, the Spirit of God spoke in me and his word is on my tongue. So in that case, it's more like being divinely inspired, which we can relate to some degree, where when you have like an artist will tell you that like when they write or before they write a song, or a creative individual will say that something comes to them. I'm not saying God per se, if it's just if it's not of divine substance what they're writing. I'm just making the point that the concept of when writing or when composing, etc., somebody, he or she, could say that they felt an inspiration. So in the case of the writings, it would be that they had felt an inspiration from God, and that was inspiring them to write. And that's what would define the third section of the Tanakh, namely the writings, which is the last 11 books of the 24 books of what we call the Bible. Is that clear? Any questions on that? Are we all good?
Who are you saying wrote those last section?
So it depends which. Psalms, King David. Proverbs, King Solomon. And so on and so forth. The book of Esther, the Megillah of Esther, was written by Esther, actually.
So did Ruth write Ruth?
Solomon wrote Ruth.
Trick question.
And Song of Songs. So King Solomon wrote three. So, I wonder if it's in that timeline that you have. Would it say who transcribed each one? Anyone find it over there yet? Maybe if you do, let everyone else know where it is so that...
Yeah, it's at the bottom.
Oh.
It says Moses wrote Job.
Exactly, as we noted before. By the way, Job was an advisor to Pharaoh. I don't know if you know that. Just, really? I'm not getting into him now. I'm just saying that he was of that era. It shouldn't surprise you that Moses wrote that book. All right, let's advance over here. And to understand what it means that the writings were written by divine inspiration, we're going to go to a text. Colin, would you like to read for us? Please, text number 5 on page 11. Page 11, text number 5. This is from Maimonides. Maimonides, in his Guide for the Perplexed, writes and describes and defines for us what it means to write with divine inspiration.
Person feels as if something has come upon them, and as they have received a new power that drives them to speak, they speak words of wisdom and compose hymns and exhort their fellows with useful advice. Or discourse on matters of communal leadership and theology, all while they are awake and in their full possession of their senses. Such a person is said to speak by the Spirit. I guess it's the Spirit of God.
Yeah, Ruach HaKodesh. Thank you, Colin. So, if we're going to say what differentiates these three, one from the next, what we basically can say to sum it up is the God-human ratio that defines each one. Okay? So, the first one, which would be the 5 books of Moses, is like basically all God. Very, very little human. Just the human writing it down. When we go to the next one, which is the prophets, over there, there's already a little bit less God, a little more human. Because the prophet had to decipher the message and convey it. So their imprint was on it. When you advance to the writings, over there, the God-human ratio is even more human than the previous section of the prophets. So that really is what's going to define the difference between each one. As we move to the next one, it's less God, so to speak, and more of the human touch on it.
How could we tell? Is there some kind of rule that you can just look at it and tell which one is which?
Well, what do you mean? Just by looking at it and tell?
Well, it was canonized. It was pretty clear that it's prophecy inside this the land of Israel. But if we look at it from a completely different point of view, like what you're saying, is then we need to have some kind of judgment, some rules of judgment of what should be the second grade books and what the third grade books.
Well, we don't necessarily have to. Because it's on us to canonize the books. It was already done 20 plus 100 years ago by the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the men of the Great Assembly in that era. And that's when it was canonized. So they obviously had the information and also the sensitivity to know what was what. That doesn't mean, by the way, that we, and hopefully we'll have a few minutes at the end of this class to explore very quickly some of the readings and see kind of some of the differences of what defines each one of these three sections. But the work was done for us, thankfully. Yes, great question. Thank you. All right, are we ready to advance? Okay. So, to summarize what we learned so far, we said that the written Torah is that part of the Torah that was communicated to us by divine revelation. Now, by revelation, we said 3 different ways, but overall, it's by divine revelation. What about the oral Torah? What about the oral Torah? And by the way, when we said Mishnah and Talmud, I brought one book of the Talmud with me off the shelf, and this is what it looks like. Look at the right side, not the left, because this is the English translation of more recently. But this is what a page of Talmud looks like. No punctuation at all, actually. And this is what's studied and analyzed and discussed in yeshivas, in rabbinical schools. and halls of Torah study throughout the world. Now, this is part of the oral Torah, and the question is, where does it come from? Now, like I said, we're not going to get into the oral Torah tonight. That's next week. But we are going to understand what it is generally and how it interplays with the written Torah. So to that extent, we will be discussing it today, just to understand what it is generally, without getting into it. Like I said, that will wait. So we have a number of sources which actually give us very mixed messages about the oral Torah. Not only mixed messages, we can even say confounding messages. Maybe even paradoxical. Let's go to text number 6, please. I'm going to go from Colin to Uri. Would you like to please read that short text for us? It's from the Jerusalem Talmud on page 12, text number 6.
Where it says scripture, yes?
Yep.
Scripture, Mishnah, Talmud, and Haggadah, even what a proficient student is destined to innovate, we already said to Moses at Sinai.
Thank you very much. So scripture, Mishnah, Talmud, and Haggadah. It's worth reading it again because we're going to be deciphering this. Even what a proficient student is destined to innovate were already said to Moses at Sinai. Pretty big statement there. Okay? That means all of scripture is the written Torah. Then we have Mishnah, Talmud, Haggadah. These are various components of the oral Torah. And what are we saying about them? Including anything that a seasoned student will come up with, even today. If a seasoned Torah student comes up with an innovative idea, everything was already given to Moses at Sinai. Okay? That's a pretty big statement. Unequivocal statement. That the whole of Torah, including the oral tradition, is all of divine origin. It was all given to Moses at Sinai. Now, let's jump a couple texts to actually analyze this a drop more before we go to the next text. If we revisit text number 6 that we just read, we actually have a paradox within this line. On the one hand, what do we say? What are we saying? That the Jerusalem Talmud is teaching us that the whole of Torah, everything comes from Moses at Sinai. Everything. Even down to what's going to be innovated today. It all comes from Moses. But one second. Didn't we just call it innovation? How could both of these be true? If it comes from Sinai, then it's not an innovation. If a student today is coming up with an innovative idea, then it wasn't given to Moses at Sinai because it's innovative. Are you following me? So how are we making the statement? How's the Talmud making the statement that everything was communicated to Moses at Sinai, even an innovative idea which will be taught in 2023? It's either one or the other. If it comes from Sinai, it's not innovative. It's not his or her innovation. It comes from there. And if it is innovative, then it doesn't come from there. So how do these two coexist in the same statement?
Well, it comes from there, but it's revealed later by that person.
Okay, you're saying something great, but we have to understand what that means. But before that, we're going to sharpen the question even more with another confounding text. One second, I want to do one more text, and then we'll discuss it a little more. In text number 9, on page number 16, Jacob, would you like to read that for us? This is also from the Talmud. And read it carefully, and everybody listen carefully, because it's you'll see why. Go ahead.
When Moses ascended on high, he found God attaching coronets to the letters of the Torah. Said Moses to God, "Master of the world, why have you need for these?" Said God to him, "There will be a man some generations hence, whose name is Akiva, the son of Joseph. And he will expound mounds upon mounds of laws from each and every tittle." Said Moses, "Master of the world, show him to me." Moses was sitting behind 8 rows of Rabbi Akiva's disciples. But he did not understand what they were saying, and he became despondent. Until they reached one teaching, and Rabbi Akiva's disciples said to him, "Master, from where do you know this?" Said Rabbi Akiva to them, "It is the law given to Moses at Sinai." And Moses' mind was eased.
Do you hear what's going on? So first of all, we have Moses finding God, attaching coronets to the letters of the Torah. If you ever looked into a Torah closely, you'll see that above many of the letters, you have these like crowns or coronets or crowns. Either one works for me, above the letters. So Moses asks God, what are those all about? So God answered that there's going to be a great sage, Rabbi Akiva, who's going to expound meaning from every single one of these. And he actually did, not just from a word in the Torah, not just from a passage of the Torah are laws derived, not only from a word, not only from a letter, but even just from the crowns, or with the crown, more or less of a crown. That's what God's answer to Moses was. So he said, I want in on this. I want to see what you're talking about. So somehow, in God's time, Moses was placed in a classroom of Rabbi Akiva lecturing, and he was sitting in the eighth row, and he's listening to the class, and he doesn't know what the rabbi's talking about. Did it ever happen to you when you're sitting in a sermon? Moses wasn't able to relate to Rabbi Akiva's teachings. He never heard this stuff before. And then suddenly one of the students asked, where's this from? Tell me. And he said, this comes from a communication from God to Moses at Sinai. And then Moses was relaxed. So what exactly is going on here? What is the story telling us? And again, we have the same paradox. Moshe was listening. Moshe is Moses, by the way. He was sitting there listening and was not able to understand what's going on. But then we say that it was taught to him by God, and he didn't know what Rabbi Akiva was lecturing about, even though it was taught to him at Sinai. How do these two things coexist? If it was all taught to him, then he should know exactly what Rabbi Akiva is talking about. And if it wasn't, then what does it mean that it was communicated to him? So again, we're left with this paradox in both of these independent teachings. On one hand, it was all given to Moses. On the other, a student today is coming up with an innovative idea. At the same token, the second text is teaching us that it all came from Moses, yet Moses was not able to relate and know and understand the teaching. So we need to clarify this idea in a very big way. So let's advance over here. And Leon alluded to this idea, but let's explore it a little bit more. So we can approach it on a number of different levels, but on a most fundamental level, we're going to understand it or try to understand it by using an analogy from the field of biology. And I am no biologist, by the way. But if we take a look at these two illustrations, actually it's in your book on page 18, figure 1.5, the Torah as a living organism. So what do you see? In image A, you see a strand of DNA. And then in image B, you see a person. Maybe holding a laptop for some reason. I don't know if that's relevant. But you see a person. So A is a microscopic string of atoms. And B is an organism that's comprised of trillions of cells. Now, somehow, A, which is just a microscopic string of atoms, contains within it everything that eventually you see in B. Okay? So the whole B was once part of A, and B is the actualization of A. But before B became B, it was all part of A. In other words, B is the interpretation of A. It's the actualization of A. And this is really what's happening when a student today is innovating an idea of Torah. So on one hand, it's innovative. It's their idea, and they're coming up with it. Because this idea, the way the student today is presenting it, never existed before. You may hear your rabbi giving a sermon, a brilliant sermon, or teaching, or class, and this idea was never shared before. But yet at the same time, it's not totally new, because it existed before in the form of A, in the code, so to speak. Because everything was given from God to Moses at Sinai. And later on, all we do is actualize or reveal, to use your term, from what God gave Moses. And from there, we reveal many, many more ideas that we didn't know of before. So we'll come to you in a second. So now we could already better understand those two teachings from the Talmud. First, we said that even something that an innovative student comes up with today was given to Moses. How? So we asked, it's either one or the other. But the truth is that now, based on this understanding of A and B, that everything that's actualized in B originates in A and once existed within A, now when this student comes up with this new idea, it already existed in A in the code, so to speak, that was given from God to Moses. And now this student is actualizing it. That's why it's referred to as an innovative idea, because it was only revealed and actualized by him or her. The other text from the Talmud is the same idea. Moses was sitting in the lecture hall where Rabbi Akiva was teaching, listening in, and he didn't understand what he was talking about. What's the reason for it? And yet he became at ease when he heard that that too was given by God to him at Sinai. So how did the two coexist? Yes, it was given to him at Sinai. And that's when he became at ease. But that doesn't mean he knew every idea the way it would be actualized by every teacher in the future. The way Rabbi Akiva was taking B out of A, that Moses was unfamiliar with. Even though the A aspect of it was given to him by God. But how Rabbi Akiva would expound the Torah teachings and the ideas of the Torah and teach them in his way, that was innovative, and that Moses never heard before. So both are able to coexist.
And that's how the Torah is relevant today.
And this is why the oral Torah, all of it, is all viewed as B. Both the Mishnah, the Talmud, and even seasoned student who's expounding on the Torah today. It's all part of the same conversation. Obviously a few years later. But it's all... Now, but... Go ahead.
No, I think what I'm hearing is... I like analogies all the time. It seems very similar to like the PhD research system. And to me, it's like applied knowledge. One is more like information. And as you evolve, right, that's when you develop wisdom, knowledge, or intelligence, or insight. So B is more that frontier, right? That we take the information and you have the knowledge, you convert it to apply new ways of thinking, and that's where...
Exactly. So we could say that A is the code,
yep,
and B is developing the code. So what was given to Moses is the code, but now you have to go unpack it and you have to go actualize it. And that's what the oral Torah is. Now, not everyone can come up with any idea and say that it's based on A and that they're just extracting something from A. There's actual methodologies of how we go about it. So it's not that anybody can just claim that their teaching is also part of the Torah. It has to be based on the methods. We actually recite them every morning, in, at least in the Chabad prayer book. It's called 13, in Hebrew it's Shlosh Esrei Midot Shehatorah Nidreshet Bahen. 13 methodologies, how one goes about extrapolating ideas from the Torah. So as long as somebody is a seasoned student and they're following this methodology, then their new idea will be able to be traced back to A, to the code that was given by God to Moses. And by the way, we'll just come back to some of the ideas that we brought up throughout this lesson. We talked about the fact that every letter in the Torah is significant. not only that we expound on every letter, but when you read from a Torah, every letter must be there. And if it's missing one, the Torah is disqualified. Now we can appreciate that a lot more, because the written Torah, that is the code. You can't mess around with the code. I'm far from a computer programmer, but just from looking sometimes in the back end of who knows what, you see a whole gibberish of letters and numbers put together, and if one of them is taken out, then the way this page is going to appear on the front end is going to be different, because you can't mess with the code. The code has to stay exactly the way it needs to be, and in the case of the Torah, every single time a Torah is written, a new Torah is written, the scribe is doing so off a previous copy, exactly letter by letter. And that previous copy to a copy before that, all the way back to the original Torah, to the master copy, if you will, that was given by God and Moses wrote down.
But the Dead Sea Scrolls, I wouldn't say there's a huge difference, but there's a significant difference between that and Masoretic text. How do we explain that?
I'm not an expert on the Dead Sea Scrolls, but the little bit that I read or studied, to whatever degree, are you suggesting that that's part of what? I mean, those were written not as early as the Torah.
Yeah, the Dead Sea Scrolls is earlier than Masoretic text. There's no meaningful difference. They say there's some differences in meaning, but primarily in the difference in spelling of the words.
It could be. I can't really comment on it. The little bit that I did look into, it seems that they were written more like by sect. Well, yes, and not in the era of the written Torah. It's more like in the time of the oral Torah, Mishnah Talmud time, roughly.
You're talking about Masoretic?
I'm talking about the little bit that I explored about the scrolls. But the truth is, I can't, I'm not an expert on
but
them, so I can't.
It goes to like, starting from the second century to the first.
What was that?
It's pretty old. It's like 200 BC.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Dead Sea Scrolls.
200 BCE. Okay, I mean, that's not. We're not talking as old as the Tanakh.
No, but Masoretic text is much later, much less, much more recent than. So we're comparing something that probably formed from 800 to 1200 to something that was going back much farther. So that's what we're comparing, not the original Torah that was given to Moses, but two versions of it.
So I'm not really certain, but my understanding is that generally it's from the second era that we're talking about. But I'm going to have to leave it at that for today. All right, so let's wrap up this idea with reading one final text, which will would you like to read, Abby? Text number 10. This is actually from a Midrash. It's on page 19, and this really brings home the idea of what the oral Torah is all about. And what's significant here is that a lot of times, and many of us even may know people like that, they'll tell you, you know what, you talk to me about the Bible, okay, that's from God. But if you tell me that the Mishnah is from God or the Talmud is from God, I mean, that's just by the sages. I don't have to respect that to the same degree that I respect the actual Bible.
The Karaites.
So the answer is in this text. Go ahead, please.
I was once traveling on the road when a person encountered me. This person had scripture, but he did not have Mishnah. He said to me, Master, scripture was given to us at Mount Sinai. Mishnah was not given to us at Mount Sinai. I said to him, my son, both scripture and Mishnah issued from the mouth of the Almighty. What is the difference between them? The following parable was said to explain this. There was a king who had two beloved servants. He gave a measure of wheat to one of them and a measure of wheat to the other. He also gave each a bundle of flax. The wise one among them took the flax and wove a beautiful cloth out of it. He He took the wheat and made a fine flour from it, sifting it, milling it, kneading it, and baking it. He arranged it on a table and spread a beautiful cloth over it, setting it aside for when the king would come. The foolish servant did nothing. Then the servant arrived in his palace and said to his servants, "My children, present to me what I have gifted you." The first one brought out the bread, made a fine flour and a table with a beautiful cloth spread over it. The other brought out the wheat in a box with the bundle of flax on top of it. Now, which of the servants is more precious to the king? When the Almighty gave a Torah to the people of Israel, he gave it as wheat from which to make fine flour and as flax from which to weave a cloth.
Thank you very much. So, when God gave the Torah to the Jewish people, his desire was, listen, he could have given us everything. He could have given us the Mishnah and the Talmud too. But he chose not to. He chose to give us the Bible together with a code with which we will then be able to go turn this flour into a delicious bread. This is exactly what he intended. He wanted a partnership here. He wanted that he made his contribution, he wrote the code, and now it's our job to go unpack that code and make our contribution by revealing and extracting and actualizing everything that existed within the code. So in the final analysis, every part of the Torah, both the written and the oral Torah, is all a product of the divine-human collaboration. Every part of it is the partnership of divine and human. The question is only to what degree. So as we said before, when you start, it's basically all divine, very little human, just Moses recording it. And then when you continue to the prophets, it's more human. To the writings, even more human. And then when you go to the oral Torah, it's even more human. In fact, over there, it looks like, or you could even be fooled to think, that it's 100% human, because it's all about the contribution that we make to Torah. It's about what the sages did throughout the generations. So you could think that it's all human. What this last text was telling us was that even the Mishnah and the Talmud, and what follows, and Maimonides, and the code of Jewish law, the Judaism that we practice today, so many of the laws that we do and follow today, for example, when we wrap tefillin in the morning, the boxes of parchment on our arm and on our head every day, besides for Shabbat, how do we know what to do? How do we know what they should look like, what size they should be, what color they should be? It doesn't say it in the Torah. It doesn't say it in the written Torah. It's expounded upon and it exists within the oral tradition. So when I'm doing this mitzvah, it almost looks like it's disconnected from the written Torah because it doesn't say there to do exactly what I'm doing. But the truth is that everything that's there within the oral Torah, the truth is that that too is part of the partnership, because everything that's revealed today, that's by a seasoned student, even what is an innovation, the truth is it all is based on the God-given code. So ultimately, it's all about the partnership, and the later we go, it's just about a more human contribution to the partnership, but the partnership remains. So, in conclusion, just by the way, because of this difference in between the oral versus the written Torah, you may be aware that every morning we recite some blessings before we actually start our prayers. And among those blessings, we say a blessing over the Torah that we're going to study that day. It's actually the same blessing that we say when someone's called to the Torah. Asher bachar banu mikal ha'amim. That's a blessing over the Torah that we're now going to hear or read. Now, any mitzvah that we do, we say a blessing before. We light Shabbat candles, we say a blessing. We take the lulav and etrog, we say a blessing. Before studying Torah, we say a blessing. But here's the question. What does studying Torah mean? Meaning, in other words, when am I required to say the blessing? What does studying Torah mean? Does it mean that I have to understand the Torah that I'm reading? What if I'm just reading words from the Torah? Do I still need to say that blessing? Is that considered Torah study? And the answer is, it depends from which book you're reading. Because only in the Bible itself, only in the written Torah, are the words significant. So if I'm going to be reading out of Genesis and not understanding anything that I'm saying, I'm just going to, let's say I don't even know Hebrew. I don't understand Hebrew. I'm just going to be reading the words. If it's from Genesis or the written Torah, I need to say the blessing before, because the words are powerful. It's the code, remember. But if it's the Talmud that I'm opening and I'm going to read it without understanding it, I can't say a blessing, because over there it's all about understanding, because it's not about the words there. There it's about the substance and the contents. And if I'm not getting it and understanding and grasping the contents, then I'm not connecting with it. It's only in the written Torah that I'm connecting with the text by just reading it and uttering it, even if I'm not understanding it. So in conclusion, for real, I hope you learned something new tonight. I'll stay on for questions. Number one, what this tells us is that every single one of us are all part of the symphony of Jewish literature, Jewish learning, and Jewish ideas. And by every single one of us studying and understanding, we have the ability to contribute in our unique way. No two people are the same. The Talmud says that no two faces are the same, and no two minds are alike. And therefore, every single one of us understands and relates to Torah differently. So nobody can contribute to Torah like you can. That's why each and every one of us need to, and we must. And finally, number one, there are